Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Will Sommer. Welcome to the Daily Beast's Fever Dreams. I'm a politics reporter at the Daily Beast, and I'm currently working on a book about QAnon called Trust the Plan for HarperCollins, coming out later this year.
And I'm Kelly Weil. I am also a reporter at the Daily Beast, and I'm the author of the book Off the Edge, Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything.
On this podcast, we're going to take you on plunges into the sometimes hilarious, sometimes scary fanatics infecting the way that millions of Americans view the world and how they vote.
Even in the aftermath of the Trump administration, the energy of these conspiracy theorists, grifters, and influencers is still pushing our mainstream political landscape closer and closer to a breaking point.
Okay, this week on Fever Dreams, we're joined once again by Sam Brody, congressional reporter for the Daily Beast. Sam, welcome back.
So good to be back. Thanks, Will.
Absolutely. So this week, Sam, we've got some big news. Q, the infamous guy behind QAnon, has returned. Did you see this?
No, tell me what's going on here.
Right. So, you know, Q, this is the guy who makes the posts that say, like, red shoes, research, Epstein, Huma, laptop, you know, that kind of stuff. And this is the sort of stuff that that set off QAnon. But Q has been silent since December 2020, when he left by posting a video of the Twisted Sister song, We're Not Gonna Take It, which has since, because of the Q connection, become a, you know, very important song for many Trump supporters. But we thought Q was gone. But on Friday night, you know, I was sitting at home, I was watching The Boys on Amazon, and I saw that another supervillain had returned, Q. And so in this case, Q returned with a comment that was very, I think, reminiscent of Jigsaw, the evil puppet from Saw. And he said, shall we play a game once more? Q. And, you know, it's been kind of a soft launch, I would say. I mean, I don't think we're getting a lot of, like, deep Q lore. Q has sort of returned and sort of said, like, time to be a patriot again. So, you know, we'll see if Q ramps things up from here.
Is this an uncharacteristically, like, clear message from Q? I'm just sort of used to, like, seeing Q drops. Am I using that right?
Yeah, that's right. Q drops, breadcrumbs.
Yeah, like, we didn't start the fire-esque mishmashes of, like, varying, like, proper nouns and
God,
things.
That's a good way to and put this, it.
And this is just, like, a clear kind of, like, obviously, like, deliberately trolly and provocative, you know, sentence, but it's comprehensible to me. So is that unusual?
Yeah, it's actually not that unusual. It's sort of like when the Q ones, kind of the Q posts that I think are probably the most influential are the ones you're describing, where it's, you know, the ones that kind of like lay the groundwork, you know, for the lore and sort of the QAnon canon, where, you know, the ones that people, you know, in the process they call baking, where, you know, it's like then you're going to go deep on, you know, Q will say, like, you know, Mockingbird, and then you go into the CIA Operation Mockingbird, and you kind of, that's the fun stuff, I think. But a lot of times Q kind of just riffs and kind of spin, you know, sometimes he does like a Q&A and he'll just sort of say things like, you know, thank you, patriots, like that kind of stuff. So, you know, sometimes it's just like a Q does an AMA essentially and kind of hangs out. But, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about, this is not the first time we've seen Q come back, although seemingly the first time, and I use this word lightly, legitimately, when I was at the Dallas QAnon convention, seemingly a mischievous administrator at 8kun, the website where Q posts, got into the back end. And I should also say, you know, because many people believe that 8kun administrator Ron Watkins is behind Q, I guess this was an unauthorized Q post, and sort of said, like, Q's back, baby. And people at the convention were hyped. I mean, they were like, Q's back, he's back. But that Q ended up being denounced sort of by the administrators of 8kun, which, you know, again, sort of demonstrates that they are the people driving the train here. Q's coming back at the time where Ron Watkins, the fellow I mentioned, who in the HBO documentary was sort of eyed as the main power behind QAnon these days, he's running what's sure to be a disastrous Republican primary campaign for a House seat in Arizona. And, you know, as that primary approaches, one wonders, you know, if you buy into the idea that he's Q, either he's like, man, my kind of, the only thing people care about me is that I'm allegedly Q. I got to get the QAnon talk going again. Or maybe he's, you know, saying, ah, oh, well, I guess I can't go legit. Time to rev up the old Q machine.
I've seen weirder sort of like strategic plays in a Republican primary. Ron Watkins is running in a district that I'm going to put on the, let's put on this political reporter Q hat on.
Get the big map out.
We're going to Chuck Todd this one. He is running, though, in a district that's held by a Democrat in like rural Arizona that is likely to flip to Republican control, crowded Republican field. And again, I go back to my initial point. I think like there are worse ways to curry favor in a Republican primary these days.
I think particularly when you think about Ron Watkins, who lived in Japan and the Philippines, only moved to Arizona. I haven't quite nailed this down, but let's say I think you could count it in terms of months. A guy who is otherwise known for running a website that was like big with mass shooters, and who has a, you know, the HBO documentary talks a lot about going to visit, I think, what is, you know, a massage parlor, effectively, has a giant an anime doll. I mean, these are the kind of things that really resonate, I think, with rural Arizona voters. But, you know, he seems to be kind of playing the one card he has in his hand.
That's right. I've spent a fair bit of time in Arizona and driving around, and it's one of a handful of states where I've actually seen a Q bumper sticker or Q sign on a car out in the wild.
Hell yeah. So, isn't that always like, whoa?
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really cool. Drive around Arizona enough and you'll get it. But, you know, I'm a little suspicious, Will, because, you know, this emergence of Hugh is coming at a time when I hear a book is slated to come out sometime soon in February 2023, which, as we all know, is an anagram for the... I don't know where I'm going with that, but it's getting a little suspicious here. So I'd like to see if you can comment on the time frame of this emergence from Q and your forthcoming book, Trust the Plan by Will Sommer.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have pointed out that Q has sort of revved up right as I begin my book promotional push. You know, this is very generous of you to set me up like this. If you'd like to learn more about QAnon, my book on QAnon and its various awful effects on our politics, on our families, on those of us who don't like crime, the book is called Trust the Plan, and it's coming out in February 2023. And most importantly, it's available for pre-orders now. I think the larger picture here is whether QAnon is really going to get going again. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we've talked about this before. It's sort of like QAnon doesn't need Q anymore, I think. It's been so mainstreamed within the Republican Party. I mean, we have QAnon believers in Congress. We have, in the case of J.R. Majewski and Myra Flores, you know, I think we're going to have more QAnon supporters in Congress. The idea that the election was stolen by a nefarious supercomputer or by 2,000 mules, I mean, these are things that could easily have been, like, next week on Q. Instead, you have a majority of the party believing it. So, you know, in a way, it's like Q has kind of just really become that firmly entrenched in the Republican Party. So, I'm not sure where Q himself can take it.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to spotlight, though, that you've really like outdone yourself on the book publicity rollout here. And so
by getting, yeah, saying, hey, Q, you got to come back, man.
Q, hey, dude, I mean, I got this book coming out. Maybe you can do the foreword. But I think you're right. Well, I mean, and we'll get into this later on the show, but Q ideas coming up in the January 6th hearings as stuff that was like legitimately discussed by people in the White House, including the president, even if they weren't explicitly labeled as Q ideas. So it's there.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it just in terms of how this stuff keeps rolling and the many just twisted aspects of it. My wife has been reading, you know, the latest draft of the book, and just every page she's saying like, oh, no, oh, no. So you know, there's a lot of material. Like she's saying, you know, don't dress your baby up as Q. That's something that, you know, someone in the book does. So anyways, so, you know, speaking of election denial and these various conspiracy theories, Sam, you got another update for us on the latest January 6th committee revelations.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this has really continued to be a pretty remarkable series of presentations of evidence and testimony from folks who were close to the Trump White House and experienced, you know, on both sides, their efforts to subvert the 2020 election. I think last week might have been one of the craziest hearings, last Thursday, just in terms of like sheer, like how close things actually came to really, truly going off the rails from like a constitutional crisis of democracy perspective. You know, former Trump lawyers and various officials testified just about the lengths to which Trump and a set of loyalists, both in the White House and in Congress, just the lengths to which they went to try and subvert the election results. And it really centered around this sort of obscure DOJ official, an attorney who actually focused on environmental law, named Jeffrey Clark, and Trump's plan to install him as acting attorney general, who would carry out his sort of far-fetched and, you know, outlandish scheme to stop the peaceful transition of power. Clark was really the last dude left who would give that a shot when everyone else basically distanced themselves from it and threatened to resign. This guy, Clark, did not seem like he had the most sterling reputation among his colleagues. And recreating, the committee sort of recreated these weeks where, you know, the White House was furiously trying behind the scenes to subvert the election by trying to place this guy, Jeff Clark, as attorney general who would slow the whole thing down.
Jeffrey Clark is kind of one of these classic Trump orbit characters where it's a guy who seems to be like pretty mediocre and sort of sees the opportunity of, you know, like in his case, sees like, well, you know, if everyone else is going to resign from the Justice Department over the coup, that creates a big opportunity for the one guy who doesn't resign. And so he kind of jumps to the forefront. I mean, the thing that struck me, and I don't know if this was in the hearing or maybe an article about it, about the whole, like, you know, attempted coup situation, was that at one point, Jeffrey Clark, you know, they're saying, Jeffrey, like, you can't be attorney general. You don't have trial experience. You haven't done criminal stuff. And he says, well, actually, like, I'm a pretty highly regarded environmental lawyer. And they said, great, we'll call you when there's an oil spill. So, you know, I mean, so, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, it doesn't seem like there was really a ton of respect for this guy within the department.
Yeah, no. And it created some moments that I think have really confirmed that, like, while this learning about this and the whole gravity of the situation is obviously very serious, it's also like hilarious. And some of the recreations of these scenes and moments like have confirmed that I think whenever the like January 6th Stop the Steal effort movie is written, it should be a Coen Brothers film and not like an Oliver Stone movie or something more serious. I just want to like highlight this quote from Eric Hirschman, who is one of the Trump lawyers who is trying to stop Jeff Clark from getting anywhere near the attorney general's office. And he recalls this moment where Clark was explaining his plan. And Hirschman said, when he finished discussing what he planned on doing, I said, F and a hole, congrats. You just admitted the first step or act you take as attorney general will be committing a felony.
Yeah, I mean, it's great.
It's really funny. I also want to just quickly note that Trump seems to have this thing for really weird, outlandish lawyers from Philadelphia. Jeff Clark from Philly. I also want to do a throwback Thursday to Michael Vanderveen, who had a star turn during Trump's second impeachment trial. He's an injury lawyer from Philly, which he called Philadelphia during an especially heated moment on the floor. So, like, to use a term often employed in the city of brotherly love, these are some jabronis, some guys that Trump seems to love having around to push his legal theories when literally no one else will.
You know, you talk about these great moments amidst the lawyers. I mean, I believe it was also Hirschman who was talking to either Clark or John Eastman, another Trump lawyer, and he said, you know, like, you better get a real good criminal defense attorney.
Yeah. Yep, that's a really good one. Should we talk about the Italian satellites, Will?
Let's do it. Yes, please.
Can you give us a little, because these came back again, but maybe for the folks who have forgotten about the Italian satellites and their really key role in the American election of 2020?
Yes. Yes. So there was in the aftermath of the 2020 election, there were certain countries that were accused of meddling in the election. Now, some of them were sort of obvious rivals or enemies of the United States, such as Venezuela, China. So you could kind of see why the conspiracy theorists cooking these up would come up with these countries. But one country that really took it on the chin was Italy, somewhat inexplicably. So there was this idea that in Italy, that these satellites, these Italian satellites, had somehow been used to steal the election. And this is a lot of these kind of conspiracy theories about the votes. They often just really quickly take it into the land of like cybersecurity and stuff like this, where I think the average person, including myself, can't really evaluate it. And so I think that makes it much, much easier to kind of get the con over, where it's just like, look, you know, I mean, I think of Mike Lindell always talking about his packet transfers and stuff. And so in this case, and I believe there's been some good reporting out there, essentially, like, someone in Italy made this claim, seemingly, you know, trying to wiggle out of some legal issues of their own. And so then the U.S. government is, in the final days of the Trump administration, really trying to track down this idea if the satellites were indeed used to steal the election. And I think it kind of gets to the, you know, really demonstrates, you know, first, I think the desperation that, you know, they're saying, well, like, I don't know, maybe we should ask Q if the election was stolen. I mean, that kind of stuff. And also, I think just the way that the Trump administration really was able to sort of harness the government.
Yeah. And I think just like the committee is recreating the moments in which these, you know, wild theories were thrown around. And just, I mean, I can't get over it. How much legitimate airtime they got among the most powerful people in the world. I mean, there's a video that the committee said was circulated by Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff. And this is just a crazy YouTube video saying MI6, the British intelligence organization, used this Italian satellite to switch the votes. And Meadows is pushing this out and gets the acting assistant secretary of defense, like a hugely important person, to contact his counterpart in the Italian government and just go, hey, man, you know, just wanted to check in about the satellites. Did you guys use those at all?
Yep, we did.
We
stole the election.
And right. I keep going back to like, this makes me think of Burn After Reading, one of the great Coen Brothers movies. And like, this is like, just this just could be a plot point in it. And it actually happened. I also just want to celebrate what Trump allegedly said when confronted about some of this stuff. And I don't have the exact quote, but basically he said, you know, you guys aren't as deep online as I am. I know a lot of stuff that's going on here. And so I think that's also a line that we deserve here. The boomer president is letting people know that, you know, he's got some good sources. He's pretty online.
It does remind you of like, you know, kind of an older person on Facebook being like, I have the best memes. like everyone loves my memes.
Did you see this Facebook thread? Have you seen that? Can you ask the Italians about this Facebook thread that I saw? Yeah, so just to close the loop here, this was supposed to be an off week for the January 6th committee. On Monday, they scheduled a surprise hearing for Tuesday. So as we're recording, that's going to be shortly. We've learned that it's Cassidy Hutchinson, who is a top aide to Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, who really seems to have knowledge and visibility into a ton of things that happened at this time. And the committee scheduled a surprise hearing because they had some urgent concerns about her safety and perhaps other things we'll learn about. So that'll be something for us to get into next week.
I kind of like the surprise witness tactic. I'm appreciating the drama of it.
They did hire a TV guy to do this. So we're going to get like next week on January 6th committee.
Yes, previously on the committee. Okay, great. So last week, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and, you know, thus set the stage for dozens of states to overturn abortion rights in those states and outlaw abortion. One of the things I was keeping an eye on was this idea, this drumbeat for several days leading up to this decision in the right-wing media, that there was going to be a night of rage from abortion rights supporters, that we were going to, cities across the country were going to burn, churches in particular would be burned and defaced. Essentially, this would be the purge. Everyone was talking about this. Sam, what did there end up being a night of rage?
I don't think there was a night of rage, Will.
No, that's right. And so this is one of these things where I was concerned, as they love to, you know, oftentimes there's these big predictions. This thing's going to happen. This thing's going to happen. In particular about like leftist violence. And, you know, it's hard to say, you don't want to say this is fake. This is fake. Because then what if it happens? Then I look stupid, right? But in this case, I felt pretty confident there was not going to be a night of rage. So just to sort of set the stage in terms of how big a story this was in conservative media, this idea that when the Roe hearing came down, we were going to just utter violence across the country, in particular violence sort of under this idea of the Night of Rage. And so Marjorie Taylor Greene says, "We are hearing serious threats of violence throughout the city being Washington." Matt Schlapp, the head of CPAC, says, "The left is heading for a Night of Rage." And then the Daily Wire's Matt Walsh says, "Bring on your Night of Rage, you demons." And so sort of that last one there kind of hints at, I think, part of the appeal of this concept of the Night of Rage for the right, which is that you then get to sort of posture and say, I hope they do try the Night of Rage in my suburb. You know, I've got a Smith and Wesson waiting for them. And so this was like a hot topic. But where does the idea of the Night of Rage come from? Well, it comes from this group called Jane's Revenge. If you haven't heard of Jane's Revenge, you might think of, well, I know NARAL, I know Planned Parenthood, kind of the big pro-abortion groups. It must have missed the text message donation request from Jane's Revenge. Well, that's because this group may or may not actually exist. So back in May, when it became clear that the Supreme Court was going to overturn Roe, I would say a communique, as they've dubbed it, essentially a couple of anonymous blog posts came out from this so-called group calling themselves Jane's Revenge, saying, you know, we're this militant pro-abortion group, and we are going to really mix it up in the streets. And their big slogan is, you know, if abortion isn't safe, neither are you. And I will say there has been some Jane's Revenge graffiti at, I believe, an attempted arson of a crisis pregnancy center, as well as some vandalism. I think maybe it's like 3 or 4 incidents of that. But at the same time, number one, no one has been arrested. We don't know of any actual members of this group. Number two, you know, I mean, Reason Magazine recently, Swin's wife, actually, Elizabeth Brown, published a thing asking whether Jane's Revenge is a hoax, whether this is, I mean, a sort of right-wing false flag. And look, I don't know. But I do think that the evidence that Jane's Revenge is this sort of nationwide gang that's going to start beating up conservatives and burning churches is pretty thin. I think if I had done the same, you know, if I had reported as much about the right based on a couple blog posts, anonymous blog posts, you know, I think we laughed off of Twitter, and rightly so. But nevertheless, this idea that Jane's Revenge is like the Weather Underground on steroids has been really big. And so we've had Republican senators demanding investigations. Marjorie Taylor Greene wants them to be classified as a terrorist group. Sean Hannity is saying, Merrick Garland, where are you? Even though there's no evidence it's a real group.
Yeah, it's super interesting for a lot of reasons. And I think what I keep thinking about is just like how powerful a foil that the 2020, you know, Black Lives Matter protests have like continued to be for the Republican Party. And I think you just have to acknowledge that that has been politically useful for them. I mean, during the discussions about the January 6th committee and what body was going to be created to investigate it, I mean, the Republican sort of falling back point was always, well, we also need to investigate the BLM riots and all political violence in this country. And it's a useful foil for them just on a lot of levels. And I think, but also, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge too that like the idea that there would be this outpouring of, you know, crazy street violence for something that was considered inevitable, right? It was May 2nd or whatever that Politico published leaked draft of the Dobbs opinion. Even when that happened, it was not exactly a totally unexpected event that a conservative court was going to issue a conservative ruling when presented a case on this. So like the idea that there would be this like outburst of violence and terrorism for a totally expected event was going to be a little bit of a stretch. But just to add on it, Will, I mean, this stuff does make it out there in real ways. I saw some tweets from folks, actually a Republican Capitol Hill press person tweeted out, and I think maybe some local news folks as well, businesses in downtown DC that, you know, had been really hit the hardest by some of the riots in 2020, you know, were boarding up their storefronts again. And who knows where those folks are getting their information or the ways in which local news sometimes picks up on this stuff. But, you know, clearly this rhetoric like has an impact. We can't know what was going through, you know, a shopkeeper's head or a business owner's, but clearly like this was considered by just presumably normies, right? Enough of a thing that You know, they felt like they couldn't take any chances and, you know, took the time to board up their businesses in response to something that we can all agree seems pretty flimsy.
We saw this, there was a Catholic diocese in California put out this memo that was then picked up by Newsweek and became sort of more fuel for this, that claimed that large groups were casing out churches for the Night of Rage. And, you know, whenever you start getting into kind of like the large groups talk, I mean, that's when I'm like, well, this is clearly a lie, because like no one's getting arrested. You know, we're not seeing any actual evidence of this. I think you make a great point about the political utility of a riot for the right. After this failed to happen, there was still like a lot of like scrambling to say like, well, it was still the Night of Rage, but it's sort of, you know, like the peaceful protesters were angry. Fox News had this thing where they said, well, it was mostly peaceful. And then I was expecting to say, okay, here's the violence we're now going to list. They said it was mostly peaceful, but some of the protests had swear words on them. And it's like, all right, well, that's still peaceful, I guess. I definitely think, you know, it has this advantage of, yeah, as you said, I mean, distracting, I think, sort of creating an equivalence with January 6th. And also, I think, distracting from the realities of Roe being overturned and saying, okay, well, now are you going to prosecute women who get abortions? Are you going to, you know, how is this going to be implemented? And instead, you can just say Antifa's on patrol.
Right, exactly.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, well, there's a lot going on this week, obviously, but you have once again submerged into the Dante-like inferno of weird shit out there and unearthed something for us to consider. So what is it this week?
That's right. I'm climbing out of that hole in like Kazakhstan that is permanently burning, and I've got a new podcast item. Yes, that's right. So this week we have the QAnon crypto scam disaster. Now, you might say, a scam in cryptocurrency? I've never heard of such a thing. But this is an especially interesting story. So this comes from a group called Logically, which is sort of an open source intelligence group that has done some great work outing some QAnon leaders. And this story is by Nick Bakovic, Ernie Piper, and Tori Marland. Now, this is a story about how, I will say, like I've known for a bit that sort of cryptocurrency scams are pretty rife in the QAnon universe, as I think they are in a lot of online communities. But there's some interesting QAnon wrinkles to this one. Just to give you the idea of sort of the basic QAnon crypto scam. So usually, like some of these are pretty unartful, I would say. They say, you know, you might get a celebrity. So it's like you make a Telegram account for Denzel Washington and you say, like, new followers, my buddy Q has told me about a great deal buying Bitcoin. However, rather than buying your Bitcoin on a site like Coinbase, just send me your money and I'll buy us Bitcoin collectively. And then, you know, this account gets about 10,000 followers and presumably some amount of money, and it's posting screenshots and what have you. And then, surprise, disappears. But this one, in this case, this is a group called Whiplash347 and Patriot Quakes, which with a quake there with the Q really highlighted in the screen name. So these are two QAnon influencers on Telegram, which is, of course, the social media site these folks have been pushed onto after being banned from the main social media platforms. Essentially, I think what is going on here is that QAnon believers have sort of self-selected and revealed themselves as sort of the among the more gullible members of our society. And so I think some con artists have seen rich pickings among them. So in this case, these two QAnon leaders, among their, you know, QAnon posts, they say, hey, I'm getting some, you know, some Q-style intel, but rather than being about Hillary Clinton and secret indictments, this is about what cryptocurrency to buy into. And so then their fans, you know, essentially they're pushing these like really crummy fake cryptocurrency coins, and these people buy them, and then they essentially just fold the coin and take all the money.
Have you looked into buying any coin just to sort of kick the tires on it?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I mean, certainly these offers looked very appealing to me. Yeah,
I mean, they look good.
It is remarkable. I mean, you know, these people are being told, well, you know, this coin is invested in gold, and you know, obviously, you know, gold is also very big in the right wing media.
Right.
And so they say, well, this this one is like really legit, what have you. And I mean, the interesting part to me here is how specific the QAnon angle is. And so let's say if you're at Miami Bitcoin Con or you're at the Bored Apes party, people are not going to be telling you about aliens necessarily and how aliens, their favorite Bitcoin, right? But in this case, these QAnon influencers do say, well, these aliens want us all to buy this fake cryptocurrency because aliens, they want us to learn about crypto so that soon they can uplift us into the stars. And so these people are going, oh, wow, holy moly. And they're putting all their money in. It's sort of a very tragic case highlighted in this article. One guy put in $100,000 and then essentially all the money was pulled out of the currency by the scammers. So he lost nearly all of it and took his own life, died by suicide. And so this is really kind of the real impact of this QAnon scam. But I think what's also interesting here is that there is this, I think what's sort of an underplayed aspect of QAnon sometimes is the sort of the idea that you personally will become fabulously wealthy. Sam, were you aware of this?
No, that's super interesting. I had no idea.
I think it's something that like can help explain part of the appeal of QAnon. And so it's based on this kind of older sort of utopian idea, which is called Nacera, which is this idea that it's very complicated. I get into the book, but basically it's this idea that there's a secret act that's been passed by Congress that will absolve all debts, you know, credit card debt, student loan debt. And also if you rent a house, you'll get that house. Or if you rent an apartment, you will now own it. So, you know, you can see how it sort of appeals to people who are in some financial precarities. So as a result, this kind of transformative wealth aspect of QAnon, I think, really lends itself to scams. And so based on that Nacera thing, people say, if you buy, you know, this crypto is part of Nacera. You know, you think of the Iraqi dinar scam where people buy these worthless Iraqi dinars and are told that they'll be hugely wealthy in the future. That has kind of been folded into QAnon. There's kind of this like special part of QAnon that makes it especially a rich vein for scammers.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And in the way you described it, it's sort of like if you're into QAnon, you're already kind of predisposed to a lot of the things that make crypto appealing for folks on the right, a distrust of the government and stuff like that. But you're also sort of like, there's this like boomer-esque susceptibility to like MLMs and sort of the rhetoric and the vocabulary of the scam that you're, you know, totally bought into if you're following QAnon. But I gotta say, like, I think the crypto stuff has revealed that so many of us are easy marks, not just the Q folks. And what I appreciate about the nature of the Q crypto is like not even pretending really, right? You know, you look at the Bored Ape stuff and, you know, they're trying to reach an audience that thinks they're like super, super smart and connected and can speak the language of financial technology and everything. And the Q people who are trying to sell this currency, I mean, aliens, right? I mean, they're just phoning it in, and you got to appreciate that level of honesty.
I think it's a diversified scam for sure.
On that note, let's wrap up this episode of Fever Dreams from The Daily Beast. In future installments, we'll also be speaking to some amazing guests at The Daily Beast and beyond, from politics to popular culture.
We hope you'll subscribe to us on your preferred podcast app and share the show on social media and at your family dinner table. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Will Summer and Kelly is at Kelly Weil. That's W-E-I-L-L. Come say hi. This podcast is produced by Jesse Cannon with music by Brian DiMeglio. Thanks so much for listening and we'll see you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.